Charles Barkley once famously said that he was misquoted in his own autobiography. Many, if not most, of the famous actors, athletes, and politicians who write a memoir use a ghostwriter. Hillary Clinton, David Beckham, Keith Richards, to name a few. Top-tier ghostwriters can earn hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. As NPR's Gabriela Emanuel discovered, it's their reward for channeling somebody else's ego.
David Fisher has written over 70 books. He's ghostwritten quarterback Terry Bradshaw, attorney Johnny Cochran, and actor and comedian Leslie Nielsen. And to see how he does it, you have to go down to the basement.
It's a real mess down there.
Boxes and boxes of cassette tapes.
I have literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tapes.
On those tapes, in Fisher's basement in the Bronx, are the lives of famous people.
Let me get in there. These should be tapes. Yep.
Secrets about the FBI's crime lab, the pharmaceutical industry's inner workings, Hollywood's real dramas.
All right, here are George Burns' tapes. Let's just see what he has to say.
There's only one reason why I wanted the show business. I fell in love with it. It's as simple as that. In fact, the more I flopped, the better I loved it.
Have you ever been terrified on the stage?
Do you still get nervous? It sounds like a joke. But I imagine you get nervous. You gotta have talent.
Fisher studies speech patterns, sentence structures, what jokes his subjects tell, and then he has to organize all the bits of information into a coherent story. Not so long ago, Fisher's profession was mostly a deep, dark secret.
Say 10 years ago, ghostwriting definitely had a sort of dirty name.
That's Madeline Morell, a literary agent for ghostwriters.
The same way as online dating had a dirty name.
Morell says those days are long gone.
And in fact, it has become a very significant subgenre in publishing. I mean, publishing is absolutely dependent on ghostwriters.
She estimates that if you look at the nonfiction bestseller list right now,
at least 60% of all those books, at least 60% are ghostwritten.
That's because celebrities sell books, but they can't necessarily write books. So what about the actual product? For that, I talked to Dan Paisner. He's ghosted almost 50 books. With Gilbert Gottfried, Denzel Washington.
I've been an autistic high school student. I've been a founder of the most successful urban fashion line. I was the 17-time Grand Slam champion.
Yep, he means Serena Williams.
I was a Holocaust survivor. What else? I was the 3-term Democratic mayor from New York City. I was the 3-term Republican governor from New York State.
But he readily admits he's not writing the next Moby Dick. His works often don't have a very long shelf life. He's often racing against the clock, the celebrity's 15 minutes of fame clock. So, while he can labor over a book for 2 years, he can also crank one out in 2 weeks, writing up to 35 pages a day. But regardless of how long it takes, he has one main goal.
The end game is to capture the tone, the voice, the essence of the subject that you're working with.
He recently did a book for surfer Izzy Paskowitz.
He comes from a legendary American surfing family. So the goal there was for his book to sound like a surfer dude, and there's no room in that experience for some ghostwriter from New York breathing down the reader's neck.
He started interviewing, gathering material, and then he started writing.
Didn't much matter to us kids if we woke up on a beach in Florida or Texas or Rhode Island or all the way down at the tip of the Baja Peninsula.
Or even the motel parking lot tucked way in the back where the street light didn't quite reach. As long as we could surf and hang out and make our little pieces of trouble.
That's Paisner in New York and the surfer himself in Southern California. Paskowitz says when he started working on the book, he had his doubts. Fast forward a year. He has taught Paisner how to surf, they have bonded over beers, and finally, Paskowitz sat down to read his own book for the first time.
It is my voice, it is my words, it is everything that I would say, and I was blown away, you know, how incredibly interesting, you know, my life was.
And his ghostwriter, Dan Paisner, says that's the point. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
Gold. It is valuable, it is beautiful, and for many in India, it is semi-sacred. India is the world's second biggest consumer of gold. And in our continuing series on women and money, NPR's Julie McCarthy examines the role gold plays in the lives of Indian women, enhancing their beauty as well as their financial influence.
The late distinguished Indian economist I.G. Patel observed, "In prosperity, as in the hour of need, the thoughts of most Indians turn to gold." No marriage takes place without gold ornaments presented to the bride. Even the poorest Indian outfits the girl with a simple nose ring of gold. The India of old was known as the Golden Sparrow. So opulent were the jewels of its rulers. For Indian women who were not formally educated, gifting them gold was their social security. Today, whether Hindu, Christian, Buddhist, or Muslim, bedecking the bride in gold invests her with good fortune. And says anthropologist Neelika Mehrotra, the spirit of the venerated Hindu deity Lakshmi.
A married woman is supposed to be an auspicious woman. She represents Lakshmi, the goddess of wealth.
Mehrotra notes in India today, land is stolen from women. Women have been disfigured in acid attacks attempting to assert a claim to family property. But gold seems to be the one asset that everyone agrees a woman can rightfully possess.
Yes, for sure, that is my property. That is my property. That is considered to be a lady's right.
Meet Anshu Srivastava, whose home is an Alibaba-like cave where all the decor is the color gold. Discreetly hidden beneath Anshu's sleeve, I spy an eye-popping array of gold jewelry.
Wow.
Yeah,
something. Okay, these are diamond and gold bangles for the audience. Stunning bangles. Bangles are the bracelets, the simple bracelets. This one's not so simple.
This is diamond and this is ruby and diamond.
You have a small fortune on your wrist.
Yes, I do.
Do you leave the house with that stuff on?
Yeah, I always wear this.
And you're not worried about being robbed?
No. If it's my destiny, it will be with me.
Anshu has gold stashed in bank vaults for her young daughter one day. She roots through jewelry boxes filled with exquisite gold from her in-laws, her husband, and heirlooms from her mother.
Somehow it gives me emotional support. Someday, if I don't have money, I can use this.
Anshu's stockpile of gold earrings, rings, and necklaces is lavish, but reflects the centrality of gold in an Indian woman's life. It's given for pregnancies, at births, when a baby first eats solid food. It's ingrained in the cultural lexicon. "My bangles sing, I'm all yours," croons the temptress in this high-wattage dance number, studded with India's top film stars from a 2001 blockbuster. In the old Bollywood classic, Mother India, gold preserves the family honor. The heroine in this 1957 melodrama is reduced to pawning her gold bangles with the cunning village moneylender to save the family farm. Music swelling, she slips off her jewels, but never lets go her dignity. So enthralled is India with gold that Indian households control an estimated $600 to $800 billion worth of it. That's nearly four times the U.S. reserves in Fort Knox. Most of it, women's jewelry. A woman's right to use the gold as she sees fit can vary in India. Anthropologist Neelika Mehrotra says women, especially some in the conservative north, require family permission to dispose of their gold.
Kind of limitation, this restriction on her right, I think suits the patriarchy. So she is not totally free. Her choice is limited by the nature of the structure of which she is a part.
When Delhi-eyed Pooja Sharma walked away from her marriage, her husband kept the mother lode of her gold. With a little jewelry she had left, she secured a small gold loan, her first, to pay her ailing father's medical bills. Pooja, a financial advisor accustomed to dealing with banks, agonized over pledging her jewels with the lender in exchange for cash.
Twice I went to them for a clarity, one branch, second branch, different branches I went. And then I decided that, okay, I'll invest.
Thousands just like Pooja walk each day through the guarded branch doors of Muthoot Finance. Nationwide every day, the firm transacts the equivalent of $50 million in gold loans at 12 to 24% interest. In 15 minutes, gold is assessed and cash dispersed, a speed no bank could match. Snigdha Paul and Sanjeev Day have a new business thanks to their $500 loan, using her jewelry and his as collateral. We're at the Socket Market. We're in the Flower Boutique, and the new proud owner is Sanjeev Day. Sanjeev, this is a dream come true.
Yeah, definitely. We hope so.
And you started it all with your own jewelry.
Yes, right. That gold has helped me. This is the example. I am also the part of this economy.
Their story is repeated throughout India. Assets of a wife put to work to build small businesses, often for a husband. The practice challenges the traditional view of gold as an idle asset. Yet economist Jayati Ghosh insists that obsessive buying of gold deprives India of genuine investment.
Gold is a pure leakage out of the system. It basically is the same as putting your money under a mattress. Well, it's really putting gold bars under the mattress. So it's a huge waste, especially for a poor economy that needs investment.
The Reserve Bank of India, their Fed, has been struggling to limit gold imports to stop depleting India's foreign reserves and to cut the current account deficit. It's had some success. But with hundreds of millions of Indians without a bank account or access to credit, using gold to secure their dreams is not about to stop. Back at Muthoot Finance, Sanjeev Day's wife, Snigdha, says she'd put her gold ring up as security again if the couple decides to expand their flower stall.
Actually, if I'm getting the benefit, then why would I say no?
That money is earning more money.
Yeah.
Money begets money.
After all, is mine. The business and gold and cash, everything is mine. So in return, I'm getting more benefit.
Snigdha is reminded that the lenders already returned her gold and that the couple's loan is now secured exclusively by her husband's gold. Snigdha just smiles. His jewelry is my jewelry. It's the new India, where traditional adornments of the old India are producing a new form of wealth for women. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, New Delhi.
This month, Morning Edition is looking at women and wealth, how women earn, access, and invest money, and plan for financial security. And on this tax day, we thought, what better person to ask about that than someone who pays out some of the taxes we pay in? Carolyn Colvin is the Acting Commissioner of the Social Security Administration. She joins us this morning from her office in Baltimore. Good morning.
Good morning.
A lot of people might think of Social Security as a kind of safety net for when they get older and they stop working. But in fact, it's not something that really goes that far. And we're seeing there's huge differences in how Social Security plays out for women. First off, about 60% of the people who get Social Security are women. Is that right?
That's correct. We find now that more women work. They pay Social Security taxes. They earn credit toward monthly retirement income at this time than any other time in our nation's history. And, of course, we find that women, due to a number of factors, seem to benefit more from this program than men.
Yet what women collect is considerably lower than what men collect. So I was wondering if you could help me out here. Let's take an average 65-year-old woman and a man of the same age. Both of them are retired. What's the amount on average that they're receiving in 2014?
Well, the average amount would be a little over $17,000 per year for men and a little over $13,000 per year for women. One of the reasons that women are likely to have lower lifetime benefit is because they often have a lower lifetime earnings than men. They are more likely than men to take time out of the workforce to care for family members. And, of course, we still have the issue of gender inequality.
But yet we know that women live longer than men, and so they're going to have to live longer on less, right?
Well, that's one of our challenges. Social Security was never intended to be the primary source of retirement. It was to be one of three legs on a stool, we always say. And so we were looking at Social Security being the basic foundation and then, of course, private pension and our savings. And we know now that many of the private pensions have been reduced. Some women work in jobs where they really don't have a private pension. And, of course, many women, particularly low-income wage earners, find themselves just not saving as much as they should in order to ensure that they are able to have a decent income during retirement.
When Social Security was first created back after the Depression, the idea was to keep people out of poverty. But now it seems like it's still doing that. Some studies show that 3 in 10 women, Social Security is like 90% of their entire income. Is that what Social Security should be right now? I mean, should we still be at a place where we're barely keeping women out of poverty?
Well, I think it does keep women out of poverty. And one of the things we stress, again, is it was never intended to be the sole source. One of the things we try to focus on is encouraging women, even at very young ages, to begin to save. There has to be more personal responsibility of saving. Many women will say they don't have the ability to save. And what I say is they cannot afford not to save, that they need to take some portion of their income and put aside for retirement.
So I think going forward, women will still have different working circumstances. You know, we're still likely to interrupt our work to take care of children or elderly family members. Do you have any real, like, sort of practical day-to-day advice for young working women now?
Well, for me, I had to find a way of saving where I would not, in fact, use that money later. And so I found, for me, real estate was the key. I also found that it did not make sense to leave money on the table. So for every job I've worked where there has been an opportunity for the employer match, I've maximized that. And over the years, that compounds in interest. And the most important thing is you need to spend below your means. One of the things I tell the young people is put in a small amount. Maybe it's giving up a soda, giving up cigarettes, which they shouldn't be doing anyway. And then each time they get a raise, don't take that raise, put it into a 401k. They haven't gotten used to spending it. It's there, and it will grow. And so I think that there are little tricks that you can do to be able to increase some security for your future.
But it's not an easy message, is it? I mean, it's hard to say that when there's nothing tangible that you can sort of point to and how this is going to benefit you in 50, 60, 70 years.
Well, it's hard when you have a low wage and you're just trying to make ends meet. But the reality is that the life expectancy has substantially increased. You can go to a life expectancy calculator on our website. Now, I've done that. I have a life expectancy of 17 more years. Of course, I'm counting on that being wrong. I'm going to live a little longer. So 71 for me, I'm 71 years old, 17 years would make me 88. I really want to live to be 100.
I don't think I want to do the life expectancy. Maybe I don't want to know.
Well, I want to know. And I think that, remember, it has a lot to do with a number of things that you can't control, you know, hereditary issues, etc. But it just gives you a sense of the fact that you could outlive your money and you need to plan to live a little bit longer. When I started planning, I thought, you know, 67, 70, because that's what we had on my father's side. Now I say 90 because my mom lived to be 89. We know that people are going to live longer. And so if they want some quality of life, there's going to have to be some focus on saving for the future.
That's Carolyn Colvin. She's acting commissioner of the Social Security Administration. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
To read financial advice from Carolyn Colvin and other women we talk to for our Women and Money series, visit our Tumblr at sheworks.tumblr.com.
Sometimes economics are turned on their head. Now, for years, Britain has had controversial austerity measures in place. Olivier Blanchard, the International Monetary Fund's chief economist, likened them to playing with fire. This past week, the IMF published its World Economic Forecast and concluded, the fastest-growing economy of any rich country in the world is Britain's. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, led the UK's austerity measures. He didn't tell the IMF meeting in Washington, D.C. this week, "I told you so," but he did say that the government's plan succeeded despite warnings from some. We're joined by Simon Johnson. He's a former IMF chief economist. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Did the IMF get it wrong? What do you make of these figures?
Well, certainly on the narrow, specific, and fair criteria of the forecast for growth this year, the IMF has changed its mind. They've revised up the growth. They haven't completely thrown in the towel. Their forecast for the fourth quarter on fourth quarter growth for next year is still quite low, only 1.8%. But there's no question they've conceded that this year they were wrong and the Chancellor was right.
Yeah. Help us understand those austerity measures, because, of course, we've seen segments of the parliamentary debate here, and I'll encapsulate it. In the simplest way, you have people in the Labour Party saying these cuts are draconian, they're ruining the vitality of our nation, and you have people in the Tory Liberal coalition who were saying they're necessary and wise.
Well, that has been the debate. I think the cuts have been a little exaggerated in terms of their immediate impact. And I would also stress that the other half of macroeconomic policy, which is monetary policy, which is what the central bank does, the Bank of England in that case, has been quite different from austerity. They've got their foot on the gas. So in this monetary policy versus fiscal policy, the easy credit is what has prevailed. The budget tightening, not so much.
So let's understand this. The budget tightening's in the government budget, but on the other hand, access to capital has been freer?
Access to credit. So the interest rate, your ability to borrow, and the Chancellor has put a lot of emphasis on providing credit to new home buyers. House prices are up quite steeply in some parts of the UK, which gives everyone a short-term feeling of prosperity and maybe it encourages them to spend. Where that leads 2-5 years down the road is another question.
What do you think politicians are going to make of this? And I mean in the US as much as the UK.
Well, it's interesting. A couple of years ago, the UK debate about austerity was quite relevant to the United States. Now I think it seems very distant. We've somewhat put our budget woes behind us. Now, I understand there's no perfect long-term budget deal. I don't think you get that in American politics. But the moment...
But the sequester has become a way of life as opposed to something that... We'll have to get rid of it as soon as we can get an agreement.
That's right. No, we have a very messy, you might even say disorganized approach to fiscal policy in this country, no question. But the idea of massive additional budget cuts being needed or on anyone's immediate agenda, I think that is completely faded. Our economy is recovering. Our tax revenues are up. The budget spending has been tilted a little bit in terms of its future projections. So I think the UK debate will not resonate at this moment in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about in Europe, though?
Well, Europe has some other problems, very big problems, recovering from their own sovereign debt crisis. The growth forecasts in Europe are still very weak. That's the IMF forecast and the Europeans' own forecast. And now we have this new shadow of potential disruptions to gas supplies from Russia because of the Russia-Ukraine relationship. That's the new wild card. And if the relationship with Russia gets worse and you get into any kind of tit-for-tat sanctions, it's the Europeans who are vulnerable to some sort of negative impact on their economy much more than, say, the United States.
How does the growth rate in Britain compare to that of the U.S. right now?
Well, the forecast for this year in the U.K. is higher than for the United States. But looking next year, looking into 2015, the IMF and other people are forecasting that the U.S. will pull ahead. So this moment of British leadership on the growth may be quite transitory.
Simon Johnson, formerly chief economist at the IMF, now professor with the MIT Sloan School of Management and senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thanks very much for taking a few moments of time away from your title to speak with us.
Thank you.